Right, we're going to read from Scripture. My name's Adam. We're going to read from Isaiah 43, 1 through 7, if you want to grab a Bible and read along. And it's up on screen. But now, thus says the Lord, He who created you, O Jacob, He who formed you, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. I give Egypt as your ransom, Cush and Seba in exchange for you, because you are my precious in my eyes, and honored, and I love you. I give men in return for you, peoples in exchange for your life. Fear not, for I am with you. I will bring your offspring from the east, and from the west I will gather you. I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, do not withhold. Bring my sons from afar, and my daughters from the end of the earth. Everyone who is called by my name, whom I created for my glory, whom I formed and made.
Great, thanks, Adam. Another insight into exile, a message to people in exile. How's it going? Good. It's great to be with you as we continue together in worship and prepare to come to the table to take the bread and the cup. I hope that this message from the book of Daniel chapter 3 will be encouraging and helpful to you as it points us towards Jesus. Before I get going, my wife wrote something on my hand or made me do it, an announcement. She has the Trump card, right? If you come and ask me to do this, I'll say no, but she's working in kids. We're building that team even further. We got a ton of little kids, and we really have a need for a team that will serve on the fifth Sunday, so every fifth Sunday, which I believe there are only three or four per year, so it's like every two or three months. We need six people to volunteer to serve on that, so if you're not already in rotation serving in there or serving elsewhere, would love to have some help. It's a ton of fun, and it's really, really valuable. We value what's happening in there as much as what's happening in here, right? It's just they're younger and has its own challenges, but this is a time for them to hear the gospel, a time for them to engage in the story of God, and so it would be super helpful. We have so many people serving faithfully, and in summer when things are scattered and low, it gets really, really difficult. So, fifth Sunday team, got that? Sound appealing? And if you're already serving somewhere else, but it doesn't interfere with that, I mean, you're welcome to dive in there. It's a pretty big need. So let Kara know, or you can tell me, and I'll try to remember to tell her. All right. Daniel chapter 3, I hope, I got the wobbliest stand here. Pardon me. I hope Daniel, and then in general, this message of our focus on the year of biblical literacy shaped by the Bible Project and a couple churches in Portland as we're walking through sort of the way they've outlined this entire story from Genesis 1 to Revelation, and obviously we have to skip quite a bit, but we've camped a little bit here in Daniel in this idea of exile, and I hope it's helpful to you. I hope you're being challenged by this idea, just like Daniel and just like his friends, of living as a creative minority within the culture God's put you in, having a minority mindset that keeps you in tension with your culture as you seek to live out your life by faith in Jesus. And so Daniel is a book that offers hope. It offers encouragement. It offers hope and promise to all exiles by reminding us, reminding exiles, which we are exiles, this is not our home, reminding us that despite, you know, all evidence to the contrary, that God is still in control. God has a plan, and God is shaping all of human history towards his end, towards his purpose, and that all of this will be revealed in Jesus in the end times. And so I hope that you find this helpful as an exile. And I was just thinking this week about that, even on my drive down here, about the weird tension in America, which we have conflated Christianity and faith and Americanism and all these things sort of blend together for us. It's really hard to discern the culture you are a part of, right? Just some of those small ways it works for us. Like on the way down here, I was thinking, oh, it's August. Oh, college football is about to start, right? NFL is right behind it. Salmon fishing is going. I got an elk tag in my pocket right now. I could run up to the Tiana Ways. Like all the things I love to do, like hobby-wise, life-wise, they really start to rear their head for me, and those are all good things, right? They're not bad things, But as I sort of sort out what it is God's called me to, my responsibilities at home, at school, at church, as a father, as a husband, and what does my heart long for and seek and enjoy, those are things that have to live in tension. Have to live in tension as I try to walk that tightrope of faith, fueled by the gospel, pointed towards the gospel. And so Daniel is helpful to that. And we have so many areas in our own culture that will challenge and stretch that. I'm on OfferUp. Anybody on OfferUp selling that stuff? Yeah, make that expendable extra money, right? Pay for daycare or whatever you need it for. So I just wander around my garage and I look for things I can do without, and I throw them on OfferUp. And we had just purchased a new air conditioner like a week ago, right before they all got sold out, right? And so we cut a hole in our wall. My neighbor helped me, a giant hole, and planted this thing forever in our bedroom. And it works great. And it's like, I came home and Kara, it was on like one of the hottest days, like 96 outside. The kids are sleeping. Kara is under the covers with a hoodie on, right? And she's like, AC works great. What we had before was a portable one, you know, one of those ones that just has a little hose. And it was starting to malfunction. It still worked. Compressor still kicked on, but it was cracked. It was leaking a little bit of water, and it would trigger the shutoff, like tanks full. You'd have to empty it like twice a night. It's still worth something. So I threw it on OfferUp and went to bed, right? And this is Monday, and so like I woke up Tuesday to 37 messages, right? People desperate for air conditioning. And I had, you know, went from, I just want to sell my air conditioner, first come, first serve, I want $50 for it, no problem. And now I have, you know, a lady saying, hey, I'm elderly, I live alone, I just had surgery, and I need air conditioning, right? Someone else saying, hey, I need this for my disabled mother, the remote control would be great for her. And so, you know, what was just, you know, and not that you have to be a Christian to act ethically, many people probably would have done the same thing, but I had to start telling people, no, I don't think this is for you, maybe I could help you or point you some other direction. Like, no, I won't sell this to you. And then other people saying, hey, I'll buy it for 20. And it's like, well, I got 37 people that want to buy it now. And I, you know, I'm in this weird tension where in America, right, in a, you know, supply and demand economy, right? Like, it's like, hey, throw it back up for $100. First come, first serve. Who wants it? Because people are desperate. And I just felt that tension, right? Like, well, I don't want to take advantage of anybody, and I don't want to disadvantage anybody by giving them an air conditioner that doesn't work really great. Like, that's, and so I know those are like first world problems, you know, like what does it look like to be faithful to the gospel in our culture, but those are many ways, small examples I think we face daily. A larger example, and I was reading, I get this magazine from Christianity Today that sends me sort of like a world watch of Christian persecution, and it just ran through the top 10 countries and started with North Korea. You're familiar with North Korea? We should be, right? It's a country that somehow, you know, we get so consumed with the Middle East, we sort of forget about North Korea. It's the most difficult place in the world to be a Christian. The hardest place in the world to be a Christian is North Korea, and Christians are tortured and imprisoned and killed, and not only are Christians, professing Christians, tortured, but the way they do it in North Korea is for any civil disobedience, anyone who goes against, you know, the dictatorship, essentially, not only do they get punished, but their kids after them, and their kids, like your entire family tree suffers consequences. And so this is a country that has a dead man for a president, right? Their founder, right, he died, and they declared him the eternal president. They renumber human history according to his birthday. Like, it's not 2017 in North Korea. It's like 105 or something like that. I'd have to look that up, right? Their founder, Kim Il-sung, is attributed with miraculous qualities, turning pine cones into bullets, turning grains of sand into rice, walking on water, all these messianic tales, all this imagery. They even have their own 10 commandments. They have 10 principles for the establishment of a one ideology system. And just think about what that means. A monolithic worldview for a country of 25 million people. We want everyone to believe and think the exact same way. And so here's some principles. I'll read like three or four of them. We must give our all in the struggle to unify the entire society with the revolutionary ideology of the great leader Kim Il-sung. We must honor the great leader, comrade Kim Il-sung, with all of our loyalty. We must make absolute the authority of the great leader, comrade Kim Il-sung. Absolute authority. We must make the great leader, comrade Kim Il-sung's revolutionary ideology our faith and make his instructions our creed. This is real. This is today. 300,000 Christians estimated living in North Korea. And that is the culture they have to navigate and think about what faithfulness to Jesus looks like in North Korea. How do you live as a Christian in North Korea? This is a country with nuclear weapons, right? The fourth largest army in the world, and they worship their founder in sort of this Stalinistic cult of personality. And all over the world, Christians are in places like that. That is the worst. But Somalia and Afghanistan and Pakistan and Syria, all over the world, all Christians are in exile, and they have significant challenges as they try to proclaim their love and allegiance to the way of Jesus instead of the way of their government or their national ideology. Can you imagine? Can you imagine what it would be like to be a professing Christian, passionate about Jesus in North Korea? It's a little humbling. Like, you know, we're trying to do a Bible read-through in a year, and, you know, I know it's fizzling. I know there's very few of us who are current, right? Myself included. I'm a little bit behind, and it's like, oh, 15 minutes a day on this iPhone 7 with, like, videos. And you know, it's like this amazing technology, and we can barely do it, and we've said this is kind of what it looks like for us to be faithful. And so, whether you're a Christian exile here, right, conflicted sort of by the values of the West, or whether you're in North Korea or somewhere else more difficult, this is the message of Daniel 3. This is what Daniel 3 speaks directly into. Now, Daniel 3, if you know it, who's familiar with it? What's the story in Daniel 3? The what? Fiery furnace, yes. Did you learn this story on a flannel graph? I know I did. I'm older. Like, the younger people learned it from talking vegetables, right? And so, Daniel 3, the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in a fiery furnace has been, you know, the way we taught it to kids and the way we use it, it's been reduced to a story just about the faith it takes to step into that furnace, right? And then we moralize it and we say this is what it looks like to follow Jesus, faith regardless of the cost. Now, that's a great lesson, right? And that is a great moral, a great example. It's an amazing example. But it's not all that Daniel 3 is speaking to. In fact, it is in the context of nationalism and idolatry as they are in exile in Babylon. And Daniel 3 is really an expose of human idolatry, the human idolatry of national identity. Tim Mackey says it this way: Daniel 3 is about what happens when we elevate our way of life and stamp it with divine authority and demand that others recognize it as well. And so as we read through this entire chapter together, think North Korea, think Nazi Germany, think Russia under Stalin, and perhaps some aspects of our own society and culture as well. How, when God's people find themselves living in a nation that idolizes the national identity, how do God's people respond? How do we live, and what does faithfulness look like? That's Daniel 3. So let's dive in together. We're going to read it all. Daniel chapter 3, verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Now, this is kind of an interesting turn if you were here last week, right? What was the story of Daniel 2? Nebuchadnezzar has a dream about what? A gigantic statue. He has this dream about a gigantic statue whose head is his image, right? Made of gold, and then, you know, silver, and then bronze, and iron mixed with clay. And the whole point of the dream was that your kingdom will fall, and there will be another one after you, and another one after that, and eventually the kingdom of God will shatter it all and be the kingdom that's established forever. And didn't Nebuchadnezzar, when Daniel interpreted it for him, told him the dream, didn't he sort of acknowledge, like, oh, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, is what he calls him. And so, yeah, he has this dream about this statue, and then the very next story, he's building one, right? He has a dream about a statue that God destroys, and the very next story, Nebuchadnezzar has an idea to build a gigantic statue 60 cubits high. Now, I know it is funny that this isn't translated for you, because no one knows what a cubit is. So this is a 90-foot-tall statue, and no one really knows exactly what it was. It seems like it's probably of their god Marduk, but it might have been of Nebuchadnezzar. And as I see stuff like this, I get kind of excited, because, you know, the reason I subscribed to Christianity Today in the first place was for the archaeology updates, like all the stuff we read about in the Bible, all the stuff they continue to find. It's amazing, right? Last year, they found an Israelite city that they had lost that's mentioned in the Bible that was a Canaanite city that they overthrew, right? And in this thing that they uncovered, they found the altar to the Canaanite gods, which were turned into a stone toilet, right? And it's right out of the pages of Scripture where it's like, hey, take their worship, their pagan altars, and I will turn them into bathrooms. Like, they literally found one. I'm amazed by that kind of stuff. And so when I think about this, I think like, oh, this would be like, wow, like a 90-foot-tall statue. That's incredible. This is a statue that would be as high as a four-story building, and certainly built on a hill with a large platform to elevate it. Plated in gold, most likely built with a wooden frame and then put together and then plated in gold. It sounds amazing, right? I mean, straight out of National Treasure or Indiana Jones and all of that. This is perfect for Hollywood, and people have tried to find this, and they think they found the base from where it was. Southeast of Babylon, you're talking Iran, Iraq. This would be in the plains of Dura, would be southeast of the city itself. And this is pretty normal. It sounds so cool to us. It's actually not uncommon for the ancient world, right? To build giant statues, giant monuments. Think of the Great Sphinx, right? The Sphinx of Egypt, to stand in the desert keeping guard. This is not just an art project, right? This communicates something about national identity. Have you heard of the Colossus of Rhodes? I think I have a picture of this Colossus of Rhodes. This is a statue even taller than the statue that Nebuchadnezzar made. It was in Greece, and according to the, they don't have pieces of it anymore, but for years it stood 105 feet tall, and they're not sure if the legs were spread like that and the ships had to sail in, or if it was just on one side. It was destroyed by an earthquake after like 80 years, and people for hundreds of years would travel as tourists just to see like its finger and its foot. But it's this statue of the sun god Helios on the island of Rhodes, 105 feet tall. And it's not an art project, right? It communicates something about Greek ideology, about Greek nationality, and nations would do this to show their strength and wealth, a symbol of national identity, of power, of might, and the extent of their rule. Right? And almost always at the gates of a city or on the road leading to a city or at the mouth of a harbor, it is announcing to the world the superiority of their way of life. This is what Nebuchadnezzar is doing. And before you think that only ancient people do this, can you think of a modern example of a monument that stands to communicate a nation's values and strength, and maybe even suggest a superior way of life, perhaps made of copper sitting at the mouth of a harbor? Yeah? So there's the Colossus of Rhodes from Greece and the Statue of Liberty saying something to whom? To the outside world as they come in, a symbol of national identity, a symbol of values. Not just a cool statue, Statue of Liberty, right? It's there for a purpose. It says something, right? It's Lady Liberty with the torch of enlightenment holding a book of law with a broken chain at her feet. It's meant to communicate something about an identity and about a way of life. It's so funny. I didn't even think of that until I read this in my commentaries. I was like, oh yeah, we have one. I was thinking, oh, it's so cool. They used to do this. It's like, wait, we have one. Think of Mount Rushmore. We just think like cool American history, right? Not only. We don't do that kind of work just as an art project or just as a historical thing. It is communicated. Those are four great rulers, four leaders of an empire, of a nation, right? It represents much, much more, okay? And so as you think about that, and then think about it, not just, see, we have parts of it, and we would consider ourselves a fairly democratic, enlightened society. Put that in the context of North Korea. Put that in the context of Rome. Put that in the context of Babylon. And so what Nebuchadnezzar is doing is he's having this giant statue to communicate Babylonian power, might, and identity, and he's having it constructed in the plain of Dura, southeast of the city, right? And he's having a big reveal party, essentially. So verse 2, Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Now this list, you'll hear it repeated, and you'll hear some musical lists repeated. This is intentional. It's a literary device. What this means, essentially, from Daniel is this idea, this important declaration, every government official, everyone who works for the government, every government official, every person in authority is to come to this dedication of the image he has set up. So verse 3, then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and the officials of the provinces. You get it, right? Everybody gathered for the dedication of the image. They stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and the herald proclaimed out loud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Can you imagine it, right? Can you see it? The imagery, this the most powerful king in the world, the largest empire in the world at the time, has built a statue, an image, and he's commanded everyone to give allegiance to it, even more to worship it, to bow down before Babylon. And he has taken his nation and elevated it to the highest level. The national identity of Babylon is now worshipped. It's so interesting, the God of Israel quickly forgotten for him. But Daniel did interpret his dream, and he confessed that God was the God of gods, Lord of kings. He even offered a sacrifice of incense. He bowed before Daniel. And now all that is gone, and this proud king has returned to the image that he loves, the symbol of national identity, of strength, his ways, and truly a symbol of his completely corrupted absolute authority, right? This is nationalism at its highest. And it's not that government is wrong. Don't hear from me any sort of bashing of human government. Human government is not wrong or bad. It's actually necessary, and God commissions it in Genesis 1. We talked about this last week. Genesis 1, if you want to turn there really quick, I'll read it from my notes. The verse 27 of chapter 1, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them, and God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heaven and over every living thing that moves on earth." Daniel said these very words to the king in Daniel chapter 2. And Genesis shows us this is what it looks like for an image to rule, right? That God commissions this, and instead of building images of the God, humans, we are the image of God. And from that, we govern, and we gather together families and cities and continents, and we are to rule as his representatives over every living thing on the earth. This gets us to the Ten Commandments. If you think about this idea of images and ruling and authority and all of this, think of Exodus 20, right? A key founding covenant document agreements what it looks like to be the people of God. "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that's in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow to them or serve them." And so Daniel and his friends, right, they know this. This is foundational to their view of who God is, a God who's brought them out of slavery, who has set them apart as his people. And they're not to make images of God. Israel is not to make an image of God, not only because it would minimize God, it would always be something less than who God is, but because God has already made images, right, in humanity, a representation of him who rule on his behalf. And what Nebuchadnezzar has done and what Daniel is speaking to in this idea of proud kings and beasts and national identity is that God is going to take this distortion of the very good thing he created and ultimately judge it. This statue represents the distortion of the very best thing God made, right? Humanity. He said it was very good. And this is what idolatry in general does, right? Is that it takes something good that God has given us and twists it and distorts it, and ultimately the thing itself is worshipped instead of God. This is not the first time this has happened in the story, right? Images and statues being worshipped. It's not the first time this has happened in Babylon. Think of Genesis, which, by the way, Genesis is such an important book. We always come back to it. Perhaps we'll land there for like 6 months when this whole series is over. Babylon is Babel. It is the same word. It is the same place. And in Genesis chapter 11, what do the people do? Come, let us build a tower that will reach the heavens. Make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the earth. This is all about humanity discarding God in an attempt to achieve and make a name for themselves, a national identity in Genesis 11, known throughout the earth. In that context, verse 8, the fiery furnace. Therefore, at that time, oh man, we're going to have to hurry. At that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O God, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Curious that Daniel is absent, right? He's not mentioned here. No one actually knows. Perhaps he's on a holiday. Perhaps he's doing something else that took his attention. He's a high-ranking government official. Perhaps he is there, and no one's telling on him, right? Perhaps they're afraid of Daniel, afraid they know the king favors Daniel. We don't really know. He's not mentioned here, but his three friends who were elevated in the last story, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or in the previous chapter, chapter 1, now have government jobs, and some people have maliciously accused them. And the accusation is interesting, right? They don't serve you. They don't pay attention to you. They don't worship your gods, and they're not responding to this image you've made. Verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now he should know this answer already, certainly. But he says, is it true? Now if you are ready, we'll do this again specially for you. When you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the bagpipe, and every kind of music, fall down and worship the image that I have made. If you do that, well and good, he says. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Isn't it crazy to see how his heart continues to twist and change? He's admitted God is the God of gods, and yet now he says, there is no God greater than me who would ever deliver you from my hands. Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered, and they said to this king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, even if he doesn't. Let it be known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. This is an amazing response, and there's been a ton of commentary written about this. We often think of our response to corrupt government as Christians, or our response to something like this, is so easy to think of the extreme polarization, right? Like that syncretism and sectarianism. And we either just go along with it and hope for the best, like, okay, I'll just bow down, but I'm not really doing it. Oh, Lord, you know my heart. I just don't want my head cut off, right? Or we're going to fight, or we're going to protest, or we're going to withdraw and take all the people who think like us over here and rail against your wickedness, and those are the extremes, and they don't do either of those things. They're actually embedded within this corrupt government. They're government officials. It was likely not a big secret about what was going to be revealed to them. I suspect they were not surprised. They knew what was being built and likely knew what was coming. It's not like everyone's out there for this big reveal, like, well, what is it? Is the king, he's going to give us gifts maybe, right? They know what's coming. And every government official must be there, and this includes them, in their government jobs, and they stand there in their Babylonian clothes with their Babylonian names embedded in so many aspects of Babylonian culture. And yet they say, no, this we won't do. This is a line too far. It's so interesting. They don't hide, right? And they don't protest. They respond peacefully, respectfully even, right? Oh, king. Three times it says, oh king, we don't even need to have this discussion. And we submit ourselves to your verdict. If you must kill us, then so be it. And if not, great. Our God will deliver us one way or another. And so we don't even have to talk about this. We just surrender ourselves to you. Just know that we're not going to worship your God. We're not going to do this thing you ask of us. This is faithfulness as an exile, discerning what compromises their identity as children of God, right? It wasn't the jobs. It wasn't the clothing. It wasn't the names. But they will not worship a pagan God at any cost. And so this is an important chapter historically. Many commentators point out that the power here is in their peaceful resistance, and this has shaped political engagement for centuries of Christians, shaped a theology of political engagement. And I don't want to prescribe for you one way or the other, because I don't think that the Bible does that for us, right? And so certainly I don't think that it's always wrong to protest, right? And the March on Selma, we can see examples within our own culture of protests that matter and protests that are important and protests that Christians should probably engage in and participate in. And we can also find many examples of people who say, no, I'm just going to sit this out. I'm not going to do that. Wherever it is on that spectrum, the idea is to discern from God what faithfulness looks like. That they yield to God, and they have a foundation and an ability to discern what would completely compromise their faithfulness as the people of God. And it's beautiful. Perhaps the most polite rebellion in history. In that place, for them and for us, I think the church has the ability to speak prophetically. To speak, if that word's strange for you, to speak with power to authority. It's very difficult to speak against your government if you have gone along with everything, if you are so much a part of it that there's nothing that identifies you as separate, right? And it's almost impossible to speak with power into the rulers of this world from a retreat center, a recluded built wall, you know, like withdrawn situation. That somewhere in the tension is faithfulness. And being able to speak to the king of the world at that point, we won't do this. We're not going to do this. It's not right. But watch out. It comes with a cost, faithfulness does. Verse 19, Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face changed. This is, if you think that's a pretty specific sentence, there's a little wordplay happening here that he can't control his own image, his own selim. Even though he can create this image and call everyone to worship it, he can't even control his own image. His face has changed in his anger against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. Again, the 7, this is an idea, it just means as hot as possible. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks and tunics. Like, just the idea is this happens really fast. We're not even going to take your Babylonian garb off. Their tunics, their hats, their other garments. And they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the fiery furnace. And you can see so much of human history in this story of what happens when national identity is deified or elevated, right? That human life has no concern. His own men are killed in this move to punish 3 people who wouldn't bow. The human life becomes expendable. But, verse 24, King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste, and he declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king, true. Don't throw us in. Whatever you say, true, we did." He answered and said, "But I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." Now, this is good stuff here. This is a theophany, a pre-incarnate Christ, which is rare biblically, not completely uncommon. Abraham, Jacob, others have had these encounters. You'll encounter it throughout the story. Well, we're going to come back to that. But something about that, Nebuchadnezzar can see that the only thing consumed were the chains or the ropes that bound them, and instead of 3, there's 4th, and the 4th looks like a god. Verse 26, Nebuchadnezzar came near the door of the burning fiery furnace, and he declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire, and the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not any powers over the bodies of these men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them." And again, we see a response from Nebuchadnezzar, just like Daniel 2. He answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own god. Therefore, I make a decree. I make a ruling. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the god of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other god who is able to rescue in this way." And the chapter ends like this. The king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon, which is interesting. This is the 3rd story in a row where faithfulness is elevated, results in their being exalted. But notice what happens in their resistance and in their trust in God, where they yield up their bodies rather than serve and worship any other god. In response to Babel, to Babylonian power and identity being worshipped, being put forward as God, they don't withdraw in protest. Instead, peacefully, they continue to be faithful, and yet they are put into the furnace. And this ought to inform how we engage faithfulness, how we see our identity, what it looks like for us to be faithful to Jesus regardless of cost, knowing that Jesus is with you even to the end of the age. Jesus says himself, "I'll be with you." I love their response, even if he doesn't, right? Even if he doesn't. Our God will rescue us. We know that he will, right? If it means death, we are rescued. But this furnace here, this experience, even if God chooses to let us be consumed by this fire, we're going to be faithful. I don't know if you like Shane and Shane. I don't even know if they're still making music, but there's a Christian, two guys named Shane, right? And they have incredible voices that harmonize. If you have not heard their song, it's called Burn Us Up. It's about this story. And, you know, we'd play it and sing it for you, but the power is in the way they do it. But it focuses in on that, man, even if you don't. I'm going to trust you, God. I'm going to step out in faith, and I'm going to pray for deliverance. I'm going to pray for this moment of pain or this experience or this trial. I'm going to pray for you to deliver me from it. But, man, even if you don't, I will be faithful. And these three men, right, they literally experienced what Adam read for us earlier in Isaiah 43. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze. Why? God says, because I'm with you, and you are my people. And so Daniel 3 helps us think about identity. It helps us, and I think this is important for where we are currently, it helps us resist the identity politics, right? Like the attachment to a view that seems to be about more than the issue itself, right? You know intuitively when you encounter it on Facebook, you're like, wow, this person is just too into this. They're too attached to this idea or this place on the spectrum. It has become not about the issue, but about identity. And I have Christian friends doing this all over the place, on both sides. We are to engage culture. We are to walk this tightrope of faith, and we are supposed to speak truth to power without compromise, standing faithful, trusting Jesus. Even if in the moment it seems like he has not delivered. Though he slays me, yet I will hope in him, is what Job said. We remember that, we walked through that. He slays me, I will hope in him. As you think through Daniel 3 and as we prepare to go to communion, as you think through this image of national identity and this call to elevate a way of life, the Bible does give us one place where the physical image of God is validated, in fact, celebrated, in fact, the very point of it, which is in Jesus in Colossians 1. Jesus, the image of God, who represents the authority of God and who then reconciles us, making peace through his blood. And let me read this to you. He, Jesus, has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom, or God has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. For he, Jesus, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, here's the imagery in the same words, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And as we think through what this looks like, not only for identity, but in our tension of walking faithfully, what this tells us is that you might not be spared the furnace, right? And they weren't, in a sense. They were, in a sense, and they weren't, right? They still were thrown in. Imagine the fear and the heat and the smell and people dropping dead next to them. And okay, here we go. They went through that. But Jesus entered the furnace with them. And he enters the furnace with us. And he allows himself to be consumed and to be beaten, to be killed. He takes on the consequences for us as he saves, redeems, and restores us. Will you pray with me? Father, as we come to the table to proclaim the preeminence of your Son Jesus, that he has made peace by the blood of his cross, that this is a finished and final work done for us by Jesus. We praise you, Lord, as we take of it, we proclaim your death until you come again. Would this bread and cup linger? Would the taste and the flavor remain as we engage the world in which you've placed us and seek to be faithful to the gospel of your Son, Jesus? We pray this in his name. Amen.